I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the London Review Bookshop. It's a real pleasure this evening to welcome Neil Astley and Fleur Adcock for an important celebration of this magnificent volume, Fleur's collected poems, just out today from Blood Axe. What an astonishing, beautiful piece of kit, the fruit of 60 years of magnificent collections. Fleur will be reading for and in conversation with Neil for about 45 minutes, following which we should have time for questions from the floor with the roving mic, following which there'll be time to buy copies of this book and get them signed and to recharge your glasses and have a chat and such like. Neil, I should mention, is the editor and publisher of Blood Axe, who have bought out all of Fleur's collections since 2000.
And earlier.
And some earlier ones,
yes.
Yes.
It's a real honour and a privilege to be here at the launch of this marvellous book. And there is some further ado. I need to say what you do if there's a fire. You just leave by the doors. And I also need to tell you not to kick over your glasses. But with no further ado than that, I'm going to hand over to Neil. Neil, thank you.
Thank you, John.
Fleur, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, it was Fleur's 90th birthday on Saturday. So we actually made Saturday the publication date of the book. I've known Fleur for nearly 50 of those 90 years. So it gives me particular pleasure to be introducing this first launch reading of this major retrospective of her work. It draws on all the collections she published from 1964 up to her 2021 collection, The Mermaid's Purse, with the addition of 20 new poems at the end of the book. Now, her pamphlet, Below Lough Rig, was actually the second publication from Blood Axe, then a fledgling small press, back in 1979, and we were fortunate in her letting us publish three further titles, two pamphlets and a translation, between then and 2000, when she brought the first of all of her subsequent books to Blood Axe, following Oxford University Press's closure of its poetry list. First of those books was Poems 1960 to 2000, for which she received the Queen's Gold Medal for Poetry. Fleur was born in New Zealand in 1934, Her ancestry is Northern Irish and Northern Middle and Midland English, and she's explored the lives of her forebears in many of her poems, as well as the experiences of her grandparents as pioneer settlers in New Zealand during the time of the First World War. Fleur herself spent the Second World War years in England, returning with her family to New Zealand in 1947. Her mother was a poet, and her sister, Marilyn Duckworth, is also a writer. As celebrated in New Zealand as a novelist as Fleur is as a poet, Fleur was presented with the New Zealand Prime Minister's Award for Literary Achievement in Poetry in 2019 by Jacinda Ardern, and Marilyn received the Prime Minister's Award for Literary Achievement in Fiction 3 years earlier. And we're also very pleased to have with us tonight Fleur's niece, Marilyn's daughter, Mia, from New Zealand, who is also a novelist, so the family tradition continues. Fleur emigrated to Britain in 1963, working as a librarian in London until 1979. In 1977 to 78, she was writer in residence at Charlotte Mason College of Education in Ambleside, Cumbria, and she was a Northern Arts Literary Fellow in 1779 to 81, living in Newcastle, and became a freelance writer after her return to London. And she's lived in the same house in East Finchley for most of that time. Our front cover portrait by Les Hansen was taken, I think, in her back garden sometime in the 60s.
70s, I think.
70s. And the equally beautiful back cover portrait, which is only on the hardback, I'm afraid, by Jemima Kufeld. That's a more recent photograph, also taken in the same house. So you have the two portraits spanning her life and work across 50 to 60 years. She writes about men and women, childhood, identity, roots and rootlessness, memory and loss, animals and dreams, as well as our interactions with nature and place. Her poised, ironic poems are remarkable for their wry wit, conversational tone and psychological insight, unmasking the deceptions of love or unravelling family lives. According to the Oxford Companion to New Zealand Literature, her poems are often written from the perspective of an outsider or express a divided sense of identity inherited from her own emigrant experience and separation from New Zealand. And all those themes will, I'm sure, emerge in the course of her reading this evening and may perhaps be enlarged upon when we have a short Q&A at the end, after which she will be delighted to sign copies of the book, which is available here in paperback and hardback. So would you please welcome Fleur Adcock. Do you want it lowered or standing?
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much, all of you, for coming. Such a distinguished gathering. Gosh. I'm going to keep changing glasses. They all look pretty similar, but they do very different things. So this is, I've been using those so I can see you, and now I need to see these pages. I'm not, this is not a chronological reading, and it's not recent poetry. It's the general span of my writing, and they're rather here and there from different periods of my life. But the first one, I thought I should read something. Since we're in this setting, I thought I should read a poem called The Bookshop. It's about a bookshop in Galway, but it doesn't need to. It was bigger than this, but it doesn't. But it's not there any longer, and this one's still going. So, The Bookshop. It's all one sentence apart from the last six words. That bookshop where the Longleys and I, drifting among the levels and chambers of its peristaltic convolutions on the last morning of the festival, were lured in different directions, sucked and digested in the dreamy caverns until we lost sight of each other and they disappeared. Or, as it seemed to them, I disappeared. Backtrack as we might, there was no reuniting under that roof. Has now, apart from its online phantom, vanished as they do. As they do. This is a poem called Things that I very often read because it's very short and gloomy and everybody can identify with these things. There are worse things than having behaved foolishly in public. There are worse things than these miniature betrayals committed or endured or suspected. There are worse things than not being able to sleep for thinking about them. It's 5 a.m. All the worst things come stalking in and stand icily about the bed, looking worse and worse and worse. Somebody did, a cartoonist did a portrait of these things climbing over the windowsill in white sheets with huge staring eyes, and there was a huddled finger under the blankets. This is called an illustration to Dante. It's looking back to, or written at the time, of the Pre-Raphaelite exhibition in the Royal Academy in about 1973. Here are Paolo and Francesca whirled around in the circle of hell, clipped serenely together, her dead face raised against his. I can feel the pressure of his arms like yours about me, locking. They float in a sea of whitish blobs. Fire, is it? It could have been hail, said Ruskin, but Rossetti didn't know how to do hail. Well, he could do tenderness. My spine trickles with little white flames. This is one Neil suggested I should read. It's called The Ex-Queen Among the Astronomers, and the print is slightly smaller, but it's quite long. This was written when I was a librarian for 20-odd years in various places, and the last 15 were in London in the Foreign and Commonwealth Office Library. Should I come out and be from behind this? Can you see me all right? So I was sitting there at the reference desk in front of a row of large encyclopedias, and in odd idle moments I could manage to read the odd article, and I enjoyed reading about astronomy. So the astronomy and the astronomers and their jargon got into a poem. And the ex-queen, there was somebody called ex-queen Soraya, who was a sort of jet-setting star media I don't know when it would have been, about the 60s, perhaps. So I like the word ex-queen, and she doesn't need to have a particular name. But it's what happens to somebody when she has had a position of importance, and particularly importance in male eyes, and then she has to change everything when she's been dumped. The ex-queen among the astronomers. They serve revolving saucer eyes, dishes of stars. They wait upon huge lenses hung aloft to frame the slow procession of the skies. They calculate, adjust, record, watch transits, measure distances. They carry pocket telescopes to spy through when they walk abroad. Spectra possess their eyes. They face upwards, alert for meteorites, cherishing little glassy worlds, receptacles for outer space. But she, exile, expelled, ex-queen, swishes among the men of science, waiting for cloudy skies, for nights when constellations can't be seen. She wears the rings he let her keep. She walks as she was taught to walk for his approval years ago. His bitter features taunt her sleep. And so when these have laid aside their telescopes, when lids are closed between machine and sky, she seeks terrestrial bodies to bestride. She plucks this one or that among the astronomers and is become his canopy, his occultation. She sucks at earlobe, penis, tongue, mouthing the tubes of flesh. Her hair crackles, her eyes are comet sparks. She brings the distant briefly close above his dreamy, abstract stare. Seems to be no ideal way of being visible and seeing you all. Try around it. A short one. This is the video. It's a poem about sibling rivalry, but it's also about my niece, Sarah, giving birth to her second daughter, and her first daughter was allowed to watch. And it's about what seemed to be at the time terribly up-to-date technology, but of course the more up-to-date the technology, the sooner it becomes obsolete. So that has now vanished. But we'll have to take it for granted. The video. When Laura was born, Kerry watched. They all gathered around Mum's bed, Dad and the midwife and Mum's sister and Kerry. "Move over a bit," Dad said. He was trying to focus the camcorder on Mum's legs and the baby's head. After she had a little sister and Mum had gone back to being thin and was twice as busy, Kerry played the video again and again. She watched Laura come out, and then, in reverse, she made her go back in. Don't think you can do that now. This is called Direct It. This is my father. He came over to England in 1939 from New Zealand, which was particularly bad year to pick, and found himself having to do some sort of a war service. But he was a pacifist. He didn't want to kill anybody. He wanted to help them. So he joined the civil defence and was part of the first aid and rescue depot, rescuing people from bombed houses or situations. I didn't do that, did I? No. Perhaps it was a bomb. So I wrote this poem looking back. First of all, it's in three sections. The first one is what I remembered at the time. My father's 40th birthday, I was 10. So they had to make some explanations to my sister and me for certain disturbance in the family. And then the second section, he's writing to his parents. His parents kept all his letters written during the war. As soon as the war was over, then they stopped keeping them. It wasn't him, it was the war they were cherishing the record of. And then finally, I did my own research and came to England and studied various documents and local newspapers. And because there was a security embargo on various things, you weren't allowed to put in the newspaper, so you couldn't say something happened in Sidcup. You had to say it happened in southern England. So there were the three sections. One, the way they told it to us at the time, if he hadn't swapped his day off with a friend to come home for his birthday, he'd have been killed. But the friend, unlike our father, was not a driver and therefore hadn't run to where the cars were when they heard the siren and was thus not killed. So that was all right, or not so bad, until you thought about it, which they hoped we wouldn't. Somebody had to run and start the cars. Two. The way he told his parents 2 weeks later, times have been quite exciting. Fortunately, I still have my lucky star and am safe and sound. Our depot, however, was completely demolished, which explains why this letter is not typed. I've lost both my cars, but they will be covered by war damage insurance. Typewriter? Cars? No word of people? Not while it's still going on, but on the day after his next birthday, June 1945, one sentence. Just a year ago today, I was helping to dig my friends from the debris of the depot. That makes me cry still. Three. So who was killed? They're in the Kentish Times. Flying bombs hit southern England. First aid and rescue service depot destroyed. Mrs. W. Symes, Miss L. Hancock, Mr. B. Hopwell, Mr. E. Ingram, Mr. Norman White, and a messenger named Smith. And there are no memorials for civil defence personnel, so not commemorated in any public way. And the messenger was, they weren't sure of his details because he wasn't on the permanent roll of the depot. He would have been somebody either too old or too young for military service who would go round on bicycle when there was a raid and take messages from one place to another when the phone lines were down. So that was my father. This is my mother. We went back to New Zealand in 1947 and start a new life, certainly a new life for my sister and me, although we had been had some memories of it. We'd been born there. But one of the things about going back to New Zealand was in New Zealand they had everything and in England they didn't have very much. So my mother's friends passed on a few unneeded clothes to her to take back and because clothes were rationed in England. And you'll see anyway. And I called it Strangers on a Tram. I like stealing other people's titles and just making a little adjustment to them. I was on a tram going home from school when who should get on it but my mother, wearing the brown tweed costume Mrs. Dowell passed on to her before we left England. This wouldn't have been so bad except that she'd let the hem down because Mrs. D had said skirts were going to be longer. Well, if so, New Zealand had not yet heard. Mothers were supposed to be stout with grey hair and not go around predicting the new look. There were some girls on this tram I sort of knew. I pretended this woman was a stranger. Amazingly, she pretended the same, apart from giving me a furtive wink. How dare she have the cheek to understand me? It was hard to work out what to resent. This is, as Neil said, I write about my ancestors a lot, and this is a very much earlier ancestor. And if a lot of my ancestry was little mill girls going off clacking across the cobblestones to work in the cotton factory. But some of them were people quite well off. And the further back you go, the more eminent they might be, because the ones that are not important don't get recorded. And this is Robert Harrington. If you have a will, it includes lots of fascinating information. And Robert Harrington died in 1558, and he rather fancied himself. So I'm making fun of him. Get you with your Almain rivets, latest fad from Germany, and your corselet and your two coats of plate. How much harness does a man need? None when he's in his grave. Your sons may have it, together with your damask and satin gowns to show off in, while you go to lie down in Witham Church, and the most armour I've seen in the will rusts or turns ridiculous in this world. I've not finished. There's just another bundle of poems here. This is called The Lipstick. There is a connection, or there's a verbal connection with the word armour. But this is really one of these guilty environmental poems. What should we do, you know? It's just called The Lipstick. If I throw it into a bin, this lipstick I bought by mistake, which wears the same metallic case as my regular pink brandy, but is so shudderingly wrong that when I use it on my lips it makes my face look cyanosed, it will finish up in landfill, seeping and oozing, leaking fats through its patiently corroding armour, wailing invisibly into the soil with its puce voice. And once it had turned into something like that, it became a soldier in the Wars of the Roses, I imagine. This is Cairn. This is a new word I learnt recently, is psychopomp. That's somebody who carries the souls of the dead across to the next world. But it's Cairn, the ferryman who carried the souls of the dead across the Styx in, classical times. And in the poem, I'm referring to somebody else with this admirable function when I discover the wonderful pun of his name. This is somebody we're supposed to disapprove of, but I find it hard to think of him as anything but a public benefactor. Of course, I'm getting on a bit. We really want somebody like this when time comes. Anyway, here he is. Where is Dr. Shipman when we need him? To ferry us across the fatal stream and land us gently in Elysium. Shipman, boatman, ferryman, whatever the craft he plies to help us cross the river, we seem to have been waiting here forever. How did we get the timetable so wrong? Things are becoming vague and we're not strong. Life was okay, but it went on too long. When we've forgotten how to keep afloat, scoop us up, doctor, in your kindly boat and carry us across the final moat. He won't, of course. This is called The Fur Line. I'm expecting a new great-granddaughter. She was due last week. She should have been born on the 3rd. And I've got 6 great-grandchildren already. And they crop up in this poem. But this is the first one my son Andrew will have had, my first grandchild he will have had. The others are children of my other son. But they're all here. And this is looking back to when I was a student. We used to have holiday jobs. I got married when I was 18. I wasn't even pregnant, but we just all, you know, had to get away. So, and I had a holiday job to keep the family coffers more or less working. And this was a zip fastener factory. It's called the Fur Line. When I was working in the factory, stitching open-ended zip fasteners at one of a row of sewing machines, someone brought in some kittens in a box. I didn't wait to consult my husband. I travelled home on the tram after work with Jonathan snuggled in my bosom. We had a cat before we had a child. Sally and Midge, Pussy Willow, Ada, all that fluff got into our synapses, transmitting itself down generations from nerve to nerve, or however it works. Tiger and Snowflake, Marigold and Prince, too late to say I've gone off predators in favour of protecting the bird life when I've bred a tribe of ilurophiles. It's out of my hands. This is the future. Brucey, Melba, Sasha, Lady Gaga. It's no surprise that my great-granddaughters grow up co-sleeping with their mother's cats. Except this little girl who's going to be born is the daughter of a dog lover, so she'll have a slightly different night. Life. This, I'm not very good at titles. This one's called In the Desert, which I think is a pretty silly title. But it's a very heartfelt poem. It's about Afghanistan, something awful is always happening in Afghanistan, and the most recent series of events made me think of my great-nephew, sorry, my second cousin once removed, Matthew Lance Bombardier, who died in 2009. He's somebody who always wanted to be in the army. An ambition, anyway. So I was watching television news and I began writing this. As the Taliban surged back into Kabul and the international correspondents looked more exhausted with every broadcast, but not as exhausted as the refugees, I thought of my young second cousin Matthew, one of the 457 flown back from Afghanistan in sealed coffins to Wootton Bassett, and then, in Matthew's case, to York for his military funeral in the Minster, after which the gun carriage paraded him on a tour of the packed streets before beginning its sedate procession to the cemetery, while we, the mourners, plus vanloads of soldiery, sped off ahead at a pace Matthew would surely have preferred, with sirens and flashing lights to get there first. All of which might have been designed to persuade his parents that being blown up by a bomb at 23 was a worthy destiny, an opinion they are perhaps revising. But I have something a bit more cheerful, I think. Don't rely on it lasting. This, I was asked, every now and then, there's a wonderful company called Candlestick Press that does pamphlets on particular subjects, and there's something like a dozen poems they commission from various poets, and they give you a topic. And they were doing a Christmas one, and they asked me for a poem. And really, Christmas isn't exactly my topic. But so I wrote them something, and then I thought, ah, no, I've got a better idea, and this is the other idea. So I called this the other Christmas poem. Or you might prefer to read about the Christmas when, after all the hosting and feasting, we finally got the kids off to bed and the rest of us, the grown-ups, if that's an accurate designation, opened up another case of wine and put on some Rolling Stones records. I think it was Ruth, a friend of a friend, who found the room a bit overheated and made the decision to take her top off, something it seemed she was given to doing at the slightest provocation. Her husband greeted this with tolerance and before too long had removed his shirt. Several other people shed theirs. One of the women undid her dress with a vaguely absent-minded air. The dancing hotted up. Ruth took off her bra. Someone stepped casually out of his trousers. You can see the way this is going. By the time Alex tiptoed upstairs for more wine from the stash in his study, the children, thank God, were sleeping soundly, he was the only adult in the house wearing so much as his underpants. Ah, what a memorable party we'd reminisce in the years that followed, thinking of the camaraderie and of how our necks had been stiff with the strain of never glancing below anyone's waist. And this is another silly title. This is called Porridge. I wrote a series of poems in memory of my friend Roy Fisher, the poet. You will know about him. He died in 2017. And I used to go and stay with him sometimes in the Peak District, and I'd make porridge for him. Not for breakfast, we tended to have it for supper. But after he died, I was thinking back about this saucepan. So I'm addressing him. I was thinking about that saucepan of yours, the Pyrex one, so improbable, made of amber glass, the colour of barley sugar, not a utensil to be used on gas, I imagined, but on your electric cooker it squatted contentedly in its glory. Everything about it looked precarious, liable to melt into golden syrup as soon as it encountered heat, or explode into a shrapnel blitz of orange splinters. But of course it was tougher than that, solid, quaint with survival from an earlier age. All you had to do was not drop it too hard. I almost felt I was demeaning it by stirring mere porridge in it, but oh, the glow. Now that the house is cleared, it must be somewhere, safe in a crate perhaps, or a cardboard box, until whatever happens to it happens. What happened to it eventually was that Roy's daughter, or her partner, brought it down to London for me, and I've got it sitting on my dining room table and I use it as a fruit bowl. Looks rather good with oranges and apricots and things like that in it. I wrote an awful lot of poems about insects. I write a lot about nature anyway, but I can't fit all those in. But this is a very short poem about one of my favourite insects, dragonfly. In the next life, I should like to be for one perpetual day a dragonfly, a series of blue-green flashes over lily tarn, a contraption of steel and cellophane whose only verbs are dart, skim, hover. One day is enough to remember. And finally, another one of Neil's requests, the prize-winning poem. It's not a prize-winning poem. I win occasional prizes, but not for individual poems, I think. But anyway, what this is about is judging poetry competitions, which I've done a lot of. And this was some years ago, later on, after I'd written the poem on the basis of what I saw in the among the entrants to the competitions, I was judging another competition, and it was organised by the Daily Telegraph, and the person who introduced it was a certain Boris Johnson, and he thought he might read this poem, so he got up and read it. I had been planning to read this poem, but anyway, Boris likes the limelight, so he got it. But this is the poem. It will be typed, of course, and not all in capitals. It will use upper and lower case in the normal way, and where a space is usual, it will have a space. It will probably be on white paper or possibly blue, but almost certainly not pink. It will not be decorated with ornamental scrollwork in coloured ink, nor will a photograph of the poet be glued above his or her name, and still less a snap of the poet's children frolicking in a jolly game. The poem will not be about feeling lonely and being 15, and unless the occasion of the competition is a royal jubilee, it will not be about the Queen. It will not be the first poem the author has written in his life, and will probably not be about the death of his daughter, son, or wife, because although to write such elegies fulfills a therapeutic need, in large numbers they are deeply depressing for the judges to read. The title will not be Thoughts or Life, or I Wonder Why, or The Bunny Rabbit's Birthday Party, or In Days of Long Gone By. Tis and Twas, Or and Ere, and such poetical contractions will not be found in the chosen poem. Similarly, clichés will not abound. Dawn will not herald another bright new day, nor dew sparkle like diamonds in a dell, nor trees their arms upstretch. Also, the poet will be able to spell. Large, meaningless concepts will not be viewed with favour. Myriad is out. Infinity is becoming suspect. Aeons and galaxies are in some doubt. Archaisms and inversions will not occur. Nymphs will not their fate bemoan. Apart from this, there will be no restrictions upon the style or tone. What is required is simply the masterpiece we'd all write if we could. There's only one prescription for it. It's got to be good. Thank you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Thanks. Well, we've got time for some questions. It occurs to me your old friend Alistair Elliot is a near contemporary of you.
Oh, yes.
And in the Second World War, his parents evacuated him to America, and he literally lived the war out on Long Island.
Yes.
You got evacuated to Britain during the war.
That was my father's ambition. He had been saving up, working. He was a teacher. His parents had very little money. They went to New Zealand to start a dairy farm, which didn't work out terribly well. And so he spent his teenage years milking cows. And then he couldn't go to university because there was no money for anything like that. So he did all his education by correspondence course until he managed to save up and managed to get a degree by correspondence course. And then he saved up to come to England to do a course in psychology. He was a scientist at heart, but you couldn't do science without a lab. So he thought psychology was the most scientific of the social sciences. And he came over, had a place at Birkbeck for the course in psychology. And, of course, 1939, the war broke out when we were on the way. So
That was how that happened.
I forget what you were going to ask.
Yeah, I mean, another interesting thing with Alistair, I mean, like you, Alistair Elliot, Michael Longley, Tony Harrison, a whole load of poets of your generation and theirs study classics.
Yes.
And doesn't seem to happen so much now.
No.
I was wondering whether you had any thoughts on the importance of classics to poets.
Absolutely, yes. Classics is the key to the English language and all the languages there are. When you learn that there are different ways of constructing a language, and there are cases and declensions and verbs doing strange things, and it makes your mind more open, and you're much better at crosswords and quizzes, and it's fun. Michael's a fantastic classicist. He can do... His translations of Homer have been read by American presidents in their speeches. I haven't done anything like that. But I did translations of medieval Latin, which is very similar to the classical Latin, apart from a few sort of differences of spelling and vocabulary. And Neil published those in a book called The Virgin and the Nightingale. And, I can read the inscriptions on tombstones. Well, I can if I have my glasses.
Both your first husbands were well-known New Zealand writers. And
yes.
Your sister also knew people like James Baxter.
I knew people like James Baxter.
And Maurice Shadbolt and all those.
Yes, we all knew the same lot. There's only a sort of limited repertoire.
But, and your first collection was published there. I'm wondering how coming out of that milieu suddenly to London, how that affected you and your...
Well, I felt I was in the wrong place. To me, London, England was the country of Shakespeare and all the people I knew and read and admired. And in New Zealand, English poetry began about the 1920s. And then, writing it. Most of the New Zealand poets were still alive, and I used to know them, and they were friends of my husband, and we'd all go to each other's parties. So it was another creation, New Zealand literature. I came back to England and feeling much more at home among the writers I was used to. But there were a whole lot of living writers, and who on earth were they? So I went to the group, Edward Lucy Smith's group, just by accident, and I met a New Zealand poet called Hubert Witherford, whom I knew, but he happened to be at a poetry reading and took me along to Edward Lucy Smith's group. And there I met Peter Porter and George Macbeth and a lot of poets, none of whom were women. They're all men in those days, in the 60s. People forget how recent the rise of publication of women's poetry is. All the publishers like Neil and Michael Schmidt and a few others started in the 80s.
Mm.
Yes. It's astonishing, really.
So how did you feel being as isolated?
Well, I thought it was just ordinary because I didn't know I was a woman. I just thought I was, I was me. Mm. When you're sitting around a table full of a lot of people at a meeting and they're all male, you don't notice that you haven't got a male face. You notice the other people and think, oh, yeah, I know that.
And in New Zealand, it was basically
in New Zealand,
there was
Ursula Bethel, who was writing in the 20s, and there were several poets in the Robin Hyde, about whom I wrote a sort of mini opera. Iris Wilkinson, her real name was, and she was a poet and journalist and travelled to China and was involved in the Sino-Japanese War. So that was, and her poetry was a bit sort of creaky and derivative, I think, but her novels were interesting. And everybody had to start from scratch there, yeah. Mm-hmm. Over here we'd had, Jane Austen and all that lot.
Can I ask you which poets you go back to now and read?
No. I don't do that. I go back, I read my friend.
Yes, yes.
I read whatever's come out that looks interesting. I used to judge a lot of competitions, not just poetry competitions, but things like the Forward Prize and other prizes where you had to read 100 books in a week or two. And then I was up to scratch on all of them. I read the Blood Axe books that come my way. They're free, and they're free to me. And that keeps me busy.
Are you still carrying out your archival researches?
Finished it. I've got as far as I can get. Most of my research was before it was on computers, or before even I had a computer. So my research was in places like the Public Record Office, the census records, and all sorts of local record offices, Lincolnshire, Leicestershire, where all my ancestors were mostly from, sort of, as Neil was saying, South Midlands, and some in the north, some in Yorkshire. So I'd go off to sit there happily scrolling through microfilm, never happier than when I was scrolling through microfilm looking for a name that leaps out of the page, and you think, oh, that's her! And you shout out. Mm. And everybody in the room understands because they're in the same frame of mind. Yeah, you recognise it.
Whereas now you could do it on the internet.
I could do, but you can't trust what you see on the internet. You have to go and check for yourself in the actual records, because it's full of amateurs getting stuff wrong on the internet. Mm. They're all just
Does anyone from the audience have a question or two?
I've got a question.
Yeah.
I'm about 12 years younger than you.
Yes.
And one thing I notice is that...
Hang on, Anthony.
And something I notice is that my generation, the really big influence was America. And yes, we really became so interested in, from the Beats to the New York School to, well, the Fugitives even before that, to Laura Riding. People, I wonder how much was American poetry of interest to you?
You know, not much at all, really. I was yearning to get back to England. I mean, I had been torn away from England like Juliet from Romeo, and I wanted to come back, and the poets, in our school library, for example, in New Zealand, we had Dylan Thomas and Eliot. I was passionate about Eliot. My friend Anne and I used to sit in the back of the maths class writing Pale Imitations of the Wasteland. And and then... I don't have this passion for American movies. Now, Hugo, for example, Hugo Williams, went to America, couldn't wait. And he was over there on a big motorbike riding around. And I rather despised all these people with their dreadful accents. I can't stand... Sorry, I'm not particularly fond of American accents. Because my ambition was to have an English accent. I got teased. When I went back to New Zealand at the age of 13, and the kids at school would laugh at me and say, say apple. No, they'd say apple. And I'd say apple. And they'd, ha, 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 say it again. And then I came to England, and then I was wandering around the National Gallery, and somebody who tried to pick me up said, are you from Australia or South Africa or somewhere? No, somewhere, but... New Zealand is quite a different type of accent too. And I can't really do it. I mean, there's a lot of it in my voice, but I can't do it at will, because I get it wrong, and it's different from place to place and from generation to generation. And
You have it in that poem that ends St James's Park.
St James, yeah. Most of it consists of St James's Park. Yeah. St James's Park, St James's Park, St James's Park. And I did. Yeah.
When you edited the Faber Book of Modern Women's Poetry, you did actually bring forward people like Jane Cooper and some very
yes.
interesting American women poets that weren't much known here.
I was at UEA when I had a term at UEA as writer in residence, and there were people in the English and American Studies department that I was friends with, Nell Altizer, Lorna Tracy, Lorna Sage.
Yeah.
Yeah. And several other people. So I got introduced to a crash course on American poetry. And there's the wonderful poetry library where my niece Mia used to work and hoped to later. And so I could go there, borrow all the books, and work my way through and make discoveries, get advice from those who knew.
Another question from the audience, perhaps? Or we can finish here and you can all get your book signed. Right. Well, thank you very much, Fleur, for that
thank
lovely
you.
Reading
thank
through
you
the collected poems.
Thank you. That was marvellous. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.